From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley is hardly known as a rhetorical bomb thrower in the Senate. He's more known for thoughtful and measured deliberation. But as he's been crisscrossing our state, holding town hall meetings, he's matching word for word the anger and outrage that constituents are expressing over what the Trump administration is doing to the federal workforce, the economy, and international order. Today on the show, you'll hear from the Oregon Senator as he pulls no punches about what's happening, his fear over what he deems a constitutional crisis, and what the Democrats and their constituents can try to do about it. Then we'll finish up the show talking with an organization that is already feeling the sting of canceled federal grants and what impact that could have on children in Oregon. The average person is seeing the chaos and confusion of the federal government from an arm's length via media reports. But Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley has a front row seat. And even though he's seen so much in his 17 years in the Senate, he tells Oregon on the Record that he's never seen the destruction and lawlessness he's seeing right now. Senator Merkley, thank you so much for carving out some time for us. How are you today?
Well, I'm well. Thank you. I have three town halls here in the Columbia Gorge. Just came from Morrow County and now I'm headed to Gillum.
Yeah, I wanted to grab just a couple minutes with you. What are people telling you at your town halls? Obviously, you and I spoke a couple months ago, and things have progressed in such a way at the federal level. What are people telling you? What are they expressing their concerns and outright fears?
A lot of concern about the destaffing and how it's all the firings and how they're going to affect the management of our Forest Service lands and our services. Very concerned about how it might affect whether or not they'll get the Social Security payments. And folks raised the conversation about Medicaid, which is the Oregon Health Plan, and whether that's going to be savaged because the House reconciliation bill envisions cutting $880 billion, so the vast majority would have to come out of Medicaid if that's going to happen. It would have a huge impact here in Oregon, where, I mean, Oregon Health Plan is not just a health insurance. It's health insurance for third estates, but it's also helping with seniors get extended care, with individuals with disabilities. It plays a key role in funding folks who are trying to recover from addiction. It covers about 350,000 children in our state. So a lot of concern about that, but then also just a lot of folks worried about a situation in which the basic separation of powers that's essential to a republic is being violated, with the president deliberately breaking the law, deliberately ignoring court decisions, and that what does that mean? Are we going to be able to save our republic? There's a lot of concern about that.
And I imagine when you're talking to people, whether it's in D.C. or here in Oregon, what are they asking you specifically, but also the Democrats? What are they asking in terms of what you can do to try and intercede on their behalf?
Yeah, so folks are asking almost every single town hall, what can we as citizens do, and what can you do as a person who's elected as part of the Democratic minority in the Senate? To the first question on what people can do, I tell them there are three things you can do. The first is don't curl up on your couch. Being in a fetal position and hoping the world will get better won't work. Second of all, hold your public officials accountable. Write to them. Call them. Protest outside their offices. Come to their town halls and tell you what you like and what you don't like. And third of all, join an affinity group. Because being angry or concerned by yourself is lonely and depressing, but when you join with others who share those concerns, it's energizing and empowering. It just really increases your effectiveness and thus is very valuable to do. In terms of what I can do as an elected, I can do a lot of things. I can slow down the process where the majority is under the rules of the Senate has to spend a certain number of hours on things. I can lobby my Republican colleagues and remind them that they took an oath to the Constitution, not to President Trump. I can forge alliances over specific issues where I know my Republican colleagues have concerns. That includes things like Medicaid and like Social Security. I can go stand in front of the Treasury Department, as I did, and lead a protest saying it's unacceptable to have Musk have access to our financial records. I can't bar Musk from getting in the door, but I can certainly help publicize what they're doing and how outrageous and wrong it is to create pressure on the administration. And I can do town halls, and I can use social media. Those are my tools, and I'm going to use them as effectively and intensely as I possibly can, given the gravity of the moment. We have rarely seen a situation when the fundamental rules of our republic, and that, I mean, checks and balances and separation of powers, are being run over the top of by a would-be authoritarian president.
Yes, and certainly one of your tools is voting, and you obviously voted against the continuing resolution. And I know that your Senate leader, you know, it seemed, at least from what, you know, we in the public saw, kind of did a 180 and voted for the resolution. Is that frustrating for you, sir, in terms of leadership, perhaps maybe not holding the feet to the fire that they could have?
Well, I strongly disagreed with my leadership on this one, and I, through three consecutive lunches, I argued that we should absolutely not be voting for the Republican proposal from the House, and my argument was pretty straightforward. That proposal doesn't have the tables attached to it on how funds are distributed, so it creates a massive slush fund for President Trump to reward states he likes and damage states he doesn't like. Massive slush fund to apply pressure to members of Congress, which is completely inappropriate. And moreover, when you are in a situation like this, you don't stop a bully by handing over your lunch money, and you don't stop a tyrant by handing them more power.
You have a front row seat, seat to what's happening, and all of us kind of, you know, secondhand see what's happening. I wanted to ask you kind of a personal question. You know, what's your level of fear as to what's happening right now in the executive branch?
We are facing a moment we have not seen, perhaps since the Civil War, in which the basic framework of our nation is at risk. What you saw Trump do when he came in, he fired the inspector generals. He's fired them illegally because you can only legally dismiss them with 30-day notice and for cause, which he didn't do either. So he broke the law straight out. He proceeded to do an executive order that violated the 14th Amendment over birthright citizenship within hours of taking an oath to the Constitution. He started firing people willy-nilly without going through what the process the law requires for a reduction in force. He started impounding money, which is not just illegal, but unconstitutional, and we went through that every which way when Nixon tried to do the same thing with grants related to the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. And when you hear him say things like, you should impeach judges who disagree with me, we are talking about someone who is an out-of-control authoritarian, and we have to use every tool at every moment to confront him. Because here's what I know, is when folks say, he has too much power, so let's wait and confront him later, what they're really falling into is a trap that has resulted in the loss of government by and for the people in one republic after another. Once you have acquiescence and the executive builds more and more power, it becomes harder and harder to confront them. So that's absolutely why we should have not passed the partisan Republican bill that handed more power to Trump.
Senator, my last question for you is simply this, and I know it's not a simple question, but it's very brief. Are we in a constitutional crisis right now, in your opinion?
We are in a constitutional crisis right now. When a president deliberately breaks the law, deliberately defies the court decisions, deliberately proceeds to violate the separation of powers, and particularly the power of the purse, well adjudicated in the past, we are in a constitutional crisis, absolutely.
Senator, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck to you. I know it's a very difficult time for all of us, and certainly you in the Senate.
Thank you.
CASA, or court-appointed special advocates, puts a legal expert with a child during the foster care process, but cuts to its federal funding may upend that mission. We talk to them now. Vanessa Nordyke, the executive director for CASA of Marion County, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Good morning, Michael. Great to be here.
Yeah. Why don't you, I know a lot of people know the organization, but why don't you just remind folks, you know, what CASA is and what you do?
Absolutely. So, Michael, there is an Oregon law that requires a court-appointed special advocate to be appointed in every case involving children in foster care. And that acronym is CASA. Mm-hmm. And the CASA programs, we are the nonprofits, the 501c3 nonprofits who recruit, train, and supervise those CASA volunteers to children all over the state. And that means that our CASA volunteers and our staff appear in juvenile court every single week to advocate for the best interests of children in foster care, including their educational needs, their behavioral and medical needs, their housing and safety needs, and so on.
Yeah. I've certainly talked to representatives of CASA before, and I can only imagine, you know, how important that is, because I can just barely imagine how both confusing and even scary, you know, the legal process would be for minors, for youth.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And one of the things that really distinguishes our program, not only are we the legal party to these children, but what we require is that our CASA volunteers build a deep bond with these kids in care. We require them to visit with them several times, at least once a month. And that's not all we do. We also meet with their teachers, their coaches, the caregivers that they live with. If they live with a foster parent or resource parent, we go and visit them. We do everything we can to get to know that child better than anybody else in the room, so that when we stand up in court and a judge asks us how the child is doing, we can speak with authority and firsthand knowledge of what this kid is too scared to say. Hmm. And that is our job.
Yeah, yeah. So kind of explain the funding model, how you're funded to be able to put these special advocates in the courtroom with these kids.
Well, Michael, there's how we are actually funded and then how we would prefer to be funded under the Oregon statutes. As I mentioned, there's an Oregon law that requires a CASA to be appointed in every case. And there's even a statute that creates the CASA fund in Oregon law to carry out this work. But historically, we've never received full funding for that program, not even close. Hmm. So in reality, our funding model is a mixture of some state dollars and the rest. We all 19 CASA programs around the state, we all have to fundraise.
Yeah. And sort of to that point, I understand y'all were kind of hoping for sort of a federal grant, and now that's in jeopardy. As we're all seeing, there's been a lot of confusion and just outright sort of back and forth with federal funding. How is that impacting CASA?
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael, for bringing this up. So we and CASA are facing some really difficult decisions due to the loss of $1.7 million in federal funding. Now, that funding was going to really help us carry out our mission to recruit, train, and supervise these volunteers. And basically the impact, what we see here, one staff member at CASA supervises up to 30 CASA volunteers. And each volunteer serves at least one child, but oftentimes in these cases, there's a group of siblings. So one staff equals up to 30 volunteers equals up to 60 children served. Wow. So losing just one staff member in a CASA program can be devastating to our impact to stand up for these kids.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine, you know, as you're looking at this with this loss, I mean, how are you going to even possibly try and make up for some of that funding, or, you know, kind of what are you going to need to do to try and survive that?
Well, Michael, again, I will do my best to speak for our entire organization.
Sure.
I am incredibly privileged to work with steadfast, committed advocates to child safety. I know that all of the other leaders of the CASA programs are going to do what I'm going to do, which is to continue to educate and inform the public about what we do, what we stand for, and how we are saving kids' lives. So I will continue to share with my community what we do and how people can help. I know Child Abuse Prevention Month is coming up. I'm going to be giving a lot of presentations in my community to educate the public and make an appeal to the friends and neighbors of my program to give us the support that we need to continue to serve as many children in care as possible.
Okay. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking with Vanessa Nordyke. She is the executive director for CASA in Marion County. You know, I am not going to ask you to weigh into the politics of sort of what's happening at the federal level, but I know that kind of some of the narrative around some of the cuts has to do with, you know, government is bloated, bureaucracy, that sort of thing. Talk about, and I know you're a nonprofit, not a government organization, but just talk about, you know, the efficiency with which you operate to provide those vital services. I think there's a lot of misinformation about how governments, nonprofits, you know, are don't operate as efficiently as private business. But certainly, you know, I've seen a lot of nonprofits that are very efficient and very conscious of every dollar.
Well, Michael, I can certainly attest to the efficiency of the Oregon CASA Network and our programs. You see, we are a volunteer-driven organization. It is community volunteers who are leading these groups in that they are the ones who go into court to speak up for the kids. We are there to guide them, support them, help them wherever they need assistance, help answer their questions, help them file their court reports. But at the end of the day, it's unpaid volunteers who are standing up for children in foster care. These are the people who are demanding that Junior gets braces, demanding that little Susie gets to go to summer school. This is volunteer driven. It doesn't cost the taxpayers money for those volunteers. What it costs is when we have staff support. But I can assure you that nonprofit wages, those, I sure wish they could be better. But I can assure you that this is an extremely efficient program because of the thousands of hours, thousands of volunteer hours that is given to each CASA program around the state.
Okay. I know, you know, you may not have sort of optics on some of the, you know, the statewide program, but I am curious, is it possible that you all might be able to sort of seek out additional funding streams? I don't know. Is it possible that you could go to the state to ask for more money to help, you know, with this budget shortfall?
We can and we have. So there are two bills being considered by the Oregon State Legislature as we speak in this legislative session, and both of them have received bipartisan support. If we are successful, and if we get everything that we are asking for in those bills, that will help make up for the lost federal funding. And we would love to have as many community members get engaged with us on that. If folks are interested in learning more about what these legislative bills do and how they can support the CASA program in their county, I urge your listeners to get in touch with your local CASA program. There's one in every county statewide. We would be more than happy to meet with you, to show you around our office, to tell you our story and our impact and how you can support our funding requests from the state government.
Yeah, and we'll make sure to put the link to CASA on our website as well. You know, Vanessa, my last question for you is this, just to kind of personalize this, if you could, maybe from your own organization there in Marion County. Tell us about, you know, a success story, if you can. You can kind of personalize what, you know, having a CASA volunteer with somebody, you know, how that, you know, outcome really, you know, was a success so that people can understand how important your organization is.
Oh, Michael, this is my favorite part of the interview. A couple years ago, it was a trio of siblings, and the oldest one had been to at least two different elementary schools, two different middle schools, and two different high schools. And the parent in their lives had bounced them around from school to school. The state finally caught up with the mom, and that is why those three girls were placed in foster care. And that is when we assigned this volunteer to those girls. And we recently had a testimonial from the eldest child. I'll call her Jane. And Jane actually ended up speaking at our CASA luncheon. Jane was, by the time she spoke to us at our luncheon in front of 250 CASA supporters, she tearfully told us her story of how she was absolutely terrified coming into foster care. And then it ended up being, as she said, the best thing that ever happened to her. She found a stable foster family, and she and the volunteer have this incredible bond. She was finally able to start focusing on her academics. And by the time she graduated from high school, she had a 3.9 GPA. And that is not, and that's not all, Michael. We stayed in touch with her, and the volunteer helped her apply to college and helped her apply for financial aid. Our office worked very closely, hand in glove, because we don't want our kids to just merely survive foster care. We want them to thrive. And so, through a lot of hard work and supporting her and empowering her, she got a full ride scholarship to Linfield University.
Well, listen, Vanessa Nordyke, I really appreciate you coming on. She's the executive director of CASA of Marion County, and wishing you the best of luck during these difficult times. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Egg prices are through the roof, so much so that many people are wondering if it would be cheaper to raise their own chickens. Well, we happen to have two expert backyard farmers here at KLCC, and tomorrow on the show, you'll hear all about the pros and cons of raising chickens at home. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.